From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, January 21st, 2020.
This Day in Maine is made possible by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And by Douglas Ridge, a new eco-conservation subdivision in Brunswick, dedicated to nature-centric sustainable home design. More at douglasridge.com.
Maine Governor Janet Mills is scheduled to deliver her first State of the State speech tonight. She's used her first year in office focusing on issues such as Medicaid expansion, tackling climate change, and solving the state's opioid crisis. Immigrant advocates and local officials turned out today in opposition to a request by Republican State Rep. Larry Lockman to not allow refugee resettlement in Penobscot County. Lockman told county commissioners that refugees would take up resources but not contribute to the area's economy.
The bottom line for me is that open borders advocates have failed to bear the burden of proving that more refugee resettlement is good for Maine.
Lockman was met with significant opposition on that point from many local leaders and advocates. A recent report also found that foreign-born residents contributed more than $1.2 billion to the Portland metro region in 2016. President Trump signed an executive order last year that would have allowed local and state officials to deny refugees resettlement within their boundaries. A federal judge blocked the order last week. County commissioners decided to table any potential action until after the matter works its way through the courts. The legislature is considering a move to invalidate state land leases for Central Maine Power's controversial plan to construct a power line through the state's western woods. The measure would allow legislative review of whether leases the state signed with CMP in 2014 and later amended were underpriced at about $100 an acre, and it would force review of whether they should have been ratified by a vote of two-thirds of the legislature. That's what the Maine Constitution requires for some state conservation lands when a, quote, reduction or substantial alteration of those lands would result. Eliza Townsend, a policy director for the Appalachian Mountain Club and former commissioner of the State Department of Conservation, testified in favor.
The legislature at a minimum should enact a finding that the transmission line of such size and scale is a substantial alteration requiring the two-thirds vote set forth in the Constitution.
In written testimony, CMP says retroactive action by the legislature to alter the existing leases would violate the state and U.S. constitutions. Committee co-chair Craig Hickman noted that the legislature has the authority to directly ask the state Supreme Judicial Law Court to weigh in on the issue. Further committee action on the proposal is pending. In weather tonight, overcast skies with a few flurries in the north and mountains and lows 0 to 11 above. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, with highs in the low 20s to the mid-30s, and on Thursday, mostly sunny and warmer, with highs in the low 30s to mid-40s. After pushback from Democrats on the proposed rules for President Donald Trump's impeachment trial, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did an about-face this afternoon. He's now offering 3 days rather than two for opening arguments from each side. Critics say it will still keep most Americans in the dark about the president's actions. But how do Mainers feel about impeachment and the process that's unfolding? Susan Sharon has more from an unscientific and brief survey we took today.
Independent Claire Abbott of Buckfield says she'd never voted in an election until 2016, when she voted for Donald Trump. And she says she'll vote for him again, despite his impeachment for high crimes and misdemeanors by the Democrat-controlled House.
I just feel that they've been after him from the beginning and haven't given up. In a whole honesty, I don't believe they have enough to convict him. I believe more witnesses do need to testify on what they know. That's pretty much it.
I'm not saying he's the perfect man, but he didn't do anything worthy of all the money they're spending here.
Michael Matthew is a Trump supporter from Lewiston who says he'll also vote for him again.
I think it's a bunch of crap, really.
Kathy Weiss of Vinyl Haven says she thinks Trump should be found guilty, but she also wants the Senate to hold a fair and thorough trial.
Don't hold back evidence, okay? Even if you don't agree with what I think, let's look at all the evidence, but don't hold back evidence.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell abandoned a plan that would have prevented evidence gathered by the House from also being entered into the Senate record. The changes came after Republicans, including Maine Senator Susan Collins, argued that the trial rules should be similar to those used in President Bill Clinton's impeachment trial in 1999. And Collins, who is up for re-election this year, is being closely watched from both sides of the aisle. It would take four Republicans to join with Democrats to get witnesses and documents introduced in the Senate impeachment trial. Andy Jones is a resident of Eustace.
I guess we're supposed to be looking at these three or four swing senators, but Susan Collins keeps letting us down. So I don't have a lot of hope that there's going to be anyone who will cross the aisle and hold President Trump accountable for what he's done.
Democrat Deborah Whitney of Limerick says she's never voted for Collins, but she's tired of hearing her described as a moderate.
People have really investigated her record and the whole myth of the moderate thing. It's very strategically based. Her moderate views are usually most felt when they mean less. People can see it now.
Whitney also thinks Trump should be impeached, and she says she's discouraged by the way the process is unfolding. But several other people we spoke to said they just want Congress to get back to its regular work. They don't like the timing of the impeachment trial, and they say there's another way to remove the president from office. Roger Quimby is an independent from Winterport who did not support Trump in 2016.
I'm not a Trump fan. However, he is our president, and I kind of respect that, and I wish the rest of the country and our legislators would just move on and do what's best for our country and vote him out if that's what they want to do next time. But I really think we should just move on. I'm really kind of fed up with it all.
Independent Maine Senator Angus King released a statement Tuesday saying, "It is more obvious than ever that this is not just a trial in the Senate. It is a trial of the Senate." For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And Senator Susan Collins also released a statement late this afternoon. She said the organizing resolution provides for a vote on whether to subpoena witnesses and documents at the conclusion of questions by senators, in keeping with the model used by President Clinton, or rather in President Clinton's trial. Collins says prior to hearing the case and the answer to senators' questions, she'll vote to table any attempts by either side to subpoena documents or witnesses before that stage in the trial. Maine's bracing for a new challenge in its response to a major substance use problem. As medical providers and social systems expand treatment options for opioid use and law enforcement continues to tackle the issue, methamphetamine use has become a growing concern. It's more prevalent and increasingly potent, and some users are turning to meth while they're still trying to manage another addiction. Willis Ryder Arnold has our story.
Alex Crowcroft sits on the edge of an office chair at the Portland Recovery Community Center in a space that looks a bit like a well-used study in a family home. The 33-year-old talks openly about the toll that methamphetamine addiction has taken on his life.
I've overdosed. I've had friends overdosing in my arms. I've had friends dying. And on top of that, in the past year, I've had 3 teeth removed. I'm going to have 3 more teeth removed. I get sick every month now, because I put my body through so much that it's not ready to heal yet.
And he says the drug has also affected others.
My mom recently told me that she was waiting for that phone call that I was going to be dead, which is a scary thing to hear from your mother, whom you love, who's been there for you and is still there for me.
But Alex is now in recovery, and part of the process involves sharing his story and listening to the stories of other people who have struggled with substance use disorders.
Hearing voices and stuff, like, it was crazy. There'd be a certain point where you would do anything for this person, and that same night, I thought they were gonna kill me.
25-year-old Alyssa is also in recovery from meth use, which she says helped create a false sense of connection with other people. But now she's found real connections with others through recovery.
Having a community to help guide me to my best life and, like, hold my hand and love me when I can't love myself has been a huge, huge part of, like, finding hope in this world again.
The methamphetamine support group is probably our fastest growing, our newest and fastest growing group.
Leslie Clark, who oversees the Portland Recovery Community Center, says meth has found a market in some former users of other addictive drugs.
what we've seen is people who may be on a medication-assisted treatment who are also now using different drugs instead of heroin are using meth.
And while some use meth to get high while attempting to kick an opioid addiction, others use it just to counteract the sedating effects of these drugs. Public health consultant Allison Webb.
And so people who use opioids, including heroin, many of them work jobs and have lives and have families. And so, you know, they do need to balance the lows of opioids with something so that they can be functional.
Perched on the edge of his chair, Alex Crowcroft recounts the evolution of his own meth usage. It started 3 years ago, while in the midst of a heroin addiction, with a crude version of the drug made in a 2-liter soda bottle.
And I bought it from these backwoods people that were making it in their shack covered in dirt. I was like, so this is, it's real and it's raw and like, cool, nice. They're hands on.
In time, he moved on to another version of the drug, which resembles quartz crystals.
And it was just shards of crystal meth, which were inherently stronger. And from what I've gathered, were being shipped here from the West Coast.
Law enforcement agencies are noting a change in the potency of methamphetamine in the state. Special Agent John DeLena of the Northeast Bureau of the Drug Enforcement Agency says much of the meth seized by agents last year has been analyzed by labs and traced to sophisticated international cartels. He says those cartels see meth as a new revenue stream.
We know that, you know, the cartels study the trends just like, you know, people study the market every day. And they see vulnerabilities, and that's what they seize upon. And that's why they're billion-dollar industries. You know, they have better research and development than Fortune 500 companies.
Maine Drug Enforcement Agency officials also report an increasing amount of more potent methamphetamine entering the state over the past several years. Concurrently, the Attorney General's office recorded an increase in meth-related overdoses in recent years. The number of deaths related to meth use leapt from 7 in 2016 to 26 in 2018. More than 17 deaths were recorded by June of 2019, which suggests that the number of deaths related to meth use is rising. But for those in recovery, including Alex, help has come in the form of group therapy and community support systems. Talking about his life, he says, offers a reprieve from his history of drug use and the damage it's done.
And if I can continue to do that and keep that in the forefront, all of that hurt that I've caused myself and others, I can live with today.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
Starting this spring, census workers will fan out across the country to confirm addresses, distribute surveys, and in some rural communities, including here in Maine, go door to door. This year, there have been concerns about the Trump administration's now abandoned efforts to add a citizenship question to the census, about cybersecurity, and about the accuracy of the count. Lisa Moore is the Assistant Regional Census Manager for the U.S. Census Bureau. I asked her what's at stake.
The census ties to what we say are two general concepts, power and money. So the 2020 census will determine the congressional representation that each state has in the U.S. House of Representatives. So that's the political stance on that. It also ties to state legislative districts as well as school districts, and depending upon the area, voting precincts. So it ties to a lot of our district boundaries and also the congressional representation in Congress. So that's the power side of it. From the other side, we say it's power and money. So the money side, the 2020 census informs more than $675 billion every single year based upon the population for federally funded programs such as our SNAP program, WIC, National School Lunch Program, Head Start, Section 8 housing. We have our hospitals that tie directly to population count and receive federal funding. So hospitals, schools, roads and transportation. A child right now, so thinking about the school funding, might be 2 years old. So making certain that child is counted as a two-year-old is really important because they will go through all of our educational programs up through middle school by 2030. So it's really important that we encourage those to complete the census so that their community receives the resources it deserves.
I have read that there are concerns that some groups, specifically non-white households, may be undercounted and other groups overcounted. This is based on a study by the Urban Institute. How is the Bureau addressing those concerns?
We are working closely with our partners throughout the state. We have staff, that's our partnership specialists, that are working with community-based organizations, faith-based leaders, businesses, nonprofit organizations, to ensure that everyone knows the value of participating as well as the importance for their community. So we are working with all groups to ensure that they're very much prepared for the upcoming 2020 census and just re-highlighting what it means for me, like the what's in it for me position. We have partners that are hosting a census solution workshop. So they're brainstorming ideas. They're collectively coming together to understand the challenges of different populations and seeing what will work to ensure that they are encouraged and actually complete the census questionnaire.
Contributing to the concerns that people do have about undercounting, overcounting, et cetera, is the citizenship question. The Supreme Court has blocked the use of that question in the 2020 census, but some communities are still worried about how the data is going to be used. How are you addressing that?
So with the citizenship question not being on the 2020 census, we need to encourage and remind everyone that as a federal employee, we are sworn to life to uphold confidentiality. So Title 13 federal law prohibits the Bureau, myself included, all of our staff that's hired on the 2020 census, and even our current survey staff, from sharing any information that would identify an individual with any other federal, state, or local agencies. We can't share information with any law enforcement agencies. We can't share with immigrations and customs. So it's really important for the public to be aware and rest assured that their data is safe and secure and that we take that oath very seriously for the 2020 census and all of the Bureau's programs.
Now, I can see people saying, you know, that's great, but the aggregate information could be used because it's public information to say, you know, target ICE raids on certain communities, things like that. Has the citizenship question and the sort of furor around it, has that made it harder for the Census Bureau to count people in 2020?
I do not think it posed a challenge on the 2020 census. On some of our other surveys and programs, we do ask that information already. So it's not a challenge that we've needed to overcome. It's something that we are dealing with on a regular basis to encourage complete and accurate data. But we understand that is a concern. So we need to work with our trusted partners to share the message so that everybody knows it is not on the 2020 census, and just re-emphasize the importance of completing the census in its entirety so that we can ensure the community receives the funding it deserves.
All right, Lisa Moore with the U.S. Census Bureau. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you, Nora. Appreciate it.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. I'm Nora Flaherty.